Radio Land. You are listening to 91.7 WHUS Stores. This is another episode of Darshiv. I am your host, Graham Stinnett, and this is the radio podcast program where we talk about archives. We talk about information work. We talk about those folks who use archival collections in their creative life, in their educational capacities. And that theme is no different today. I am joined by a guest and colleague and friend, Emily Larned, who is an associate professor of art in graphic design at the University of Connecticut, as well as the co-founder of Impractical Labor in Service of the Speculative Arts. Emily, welcome to the show.
Graham, thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So you have had a long history in various kinds of art engagement. You are a world traveler. You teach here at the University of Connecticut, which we are very fortunate for, specifically because you are situated towards thinking about collections, producing material through your classes, yourself as an artist producing material that has archival value, special collections value. And there's so many things that we could talk about, but specifically, I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about your initial inspiration around archives. You know, you incorporate our collections certainly in your classes at least once a year, and I'm kind of wondering if you could tell me a little bit about when it was that you got interested in special collections as a place that an artist might go to kind of draw from either its inspiration or its historical value. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this was such a helpful question to reflect upon because I hadn't thought about this for a long time in terms of how I first started working with special collections. But it was actually when I was an undergraduate myself. So I went to Wesleyan, also here in Connecticut. And I had two mentors there, Susie Taraba, who is the head of special collections. She just retired a year ago. And Robin Price, who's an artist and letterpress printer and bookmaker in Middletown, Connecticut. And I think it must have been Robin who introduced me to Susie. So when I was maybe like a junior in college and I had started working with Robin as an assistant, and Robin was like, well, you make books, right? Like you've been making zines since you were 16 and now you're interested in making artist books and you're learning letterpress printing and bookbinding. You really need to know about special collections here at the university because they have a ton of handmade books that you could go and look at any time. And so I started first looking at artist books in the university collection. But in working with Robin, we were working on a book together called Slurring at Bottom, A Printer's Book of Errors. And in that book, she was exploring a lot of ideas about chance operations. And the John Cage papers happened to be at Wesleyan University. So we spent a day looking through the John Cage papers. And I think it was at that point where I realized this sense of potential in all these unpublished materials that basically it's all these process documents, right? Where things, it's like you can trace somebody's thought operations. You can kind of see where they took a left turn and then maybe left something behind that was also super interesting, but isn't what they ended up pursuing. So it just seemed to me so much like a site of potential that there's all these tangents and things that haven't been recirculated, or yeah, it's so much like opportunity. And so that's what got me interested in using more of like the archive side of special collections as opposed to say like an artist book collection.
Right. So that specimen aspect of special collections, you know, as I mentioned, you bring your classes in to see very specific things. When we get the email from Emily that says, I need broadsides specifically, I need zines specifically, you know, I know you're looking for the format in which to kind of open up that avenue for students to kind of think about process on the one hand, format, but also, you know, what is the creative aspect I'm sure you're talking about in studio. But in terms of the happenstance, the unexpected, you know, this is something that I'm really excited to hear that you have kind of done that extra dig through collections, because I feel like that's something artists, you know, we all are pressed for time all the time to make a turnaround, but trying to make a seamless pitch that like you might not expect what you're going to get. Please spend some time hoping to find something.
That, to me, that's what libraries are, right? And so like whenever things are like a closed stack library, it's much harder to have that opportunity. But then something like the archive, like the alternative press collection here at the Dodd, and how there's a finding aid that's a list, right? Where it's like a list of both topics, but also like, say, the publisher of all the different papers. I love the fact that there's this way of using the list as a point of entry where it's almost abstracted, you know, but then it's a way for either, you know, so as you know, I like to use this with my students. Like I give them the list of alternative press collection titles, and then they choose ones that they find evocative, and they have to kind of like think backwards, right, in terms of thinking about if they're interested in something like reproductive rights, like how many different ways that could appear in the list, and you know, how do they cover their bases of making sure that they get to see enough folders, because one folder might have just like one item in it, while other folders might be really, really thick and it's going to take a long time to get through, but that's part of this opportunity of discovery. And it's really about following your curiosity and just making time to follow your curiosity, and also being open to the idea of that you might not find anything and that it might not happen that first time, but that trusting the process, that it's worth it, that there's things out there worth discovering. It may not just happen right away. And so I think in that exercise, there's just an opportunity for students to follow their curiosity and then potentially discover something, as opposed to, say, you know, in some of my other uses of the archives, I am very specific, right? Like, I'm like, we need to see zines starting from like the 1930s science fiction through, like, we need to see some punk rock from like the 70s. We need to see some like 90s personal zines, or we need to see broadsides that have some type of social engagement feature. Often because in those cases, I'm wanting students to think about how print lives in the world, and like how print creates an audience, you know, and like how print circulates. Like, that's a big part of, I think, thinking about those assignments. And then something like the alternative press collection assignment is more about allowing students to discover what they're interested in, that they might not even know, right? They might even start with a list and be like, you know, like staring at a blank piece of paper. They just have to choose something. So to me, yeah, there's not just one way I use the archives in my teaching. Like, it's like a, how do you say, it's like a continuous fount. Is that the word, fount?
Right, where you're going back
yes,
to it.
Yes.
And you might not get back the same result as
that's
you did
right.
the previous time.
That's right. But there's always something to be discovered, right? And yeah, I feel so fortunate to be here at UConn with such a great collection and such a great archivist.
Thank you, Emily. I'm glad you sort of segued into that experiment that we have done with, yeah, letting them fish, basically, mm-hmm. for a topic. And just to kind of plug the provenance of that, this is the Alternative Press File Collection, which was started by Richard Aykroyd in 1967. He has been a guest on this program. And that's also kind of just like this artificial collection, the archival process of bringing in subject files. Over 4,000 of them is basically because the archivist was going and grabbing things off of the landscape, like not really having these large buckets already for, you know, the you know, anti-fascism movement or the book arts New York trade fair bucket, because it runs that kind of a gamut, right? Mm-hmm. It's like very subject based, but then also like, oh, two publications about the alert in, you know, the crisis of El Salvador in 1986. So having the ability to kind of draw your students to that list is a great way of having them almost tell us also what is the value of this.
It's also, you know what, it's like the anti-algorithm, because so often students are just being fed content based upon things that they've already looked at. And so they very rarely in navigating social media or the internet, like they're very rarely, I think, accessing something randomly and new. Like, it's always kind of in response to something else they had searched before. And that's what I love about, say, the alternative press collection list, is that they are going through that list and they have to respond to it freshly. Nothing is being fed to them, you know, and nothing is being how do you say, boosted by sponsored content. Like they are the ones who get to make the choice, and they have to ask themselves like what they're interested in right now, right? Not last week or based upon searching from 6 months ago, but that day, like what is it that resonates? Like what are they curious about? What do they want to explore further?
I'm so glad you said that. Like, I want you to talk so much more about that because I have so many thoughts, and just the idea of how data gets aggregated about collections and how it then gets served to become something that you put on your list of what has potential value. You know, this is like the struggle of archives, is trying to like not over describe something so that we're doing your research for you, but teasing it enough through a finding aid or through some metadata on the digital repository or in metadata for a book, for example, that then gets you sort of like interested enough to want to come and see the actual thing versus like, just show me the thing.
That is such a difficult challenge, I can imagine. Because, you know, another way students can navigate the alternative press collection is that some of the content does have the cover scanned, right? And so, especially, you know, my students are mostly design students or art students, and so they're very interested in what the publication looks like, right? And so for them, it's very tempting to choose by the image on the cover, but I try to like encourage them to not exclusively choose that way, because it's worth exploring it from multiple sides, right? Although at the same time, that's very helpful information, and especially it's very enticing and exciting and brings a lot of people in too, you know? So I can see the challenge. I also wonder about, and again, this is kind of perhaps getting off topic, but the nature of digitizing publications when they were made at a time when somebody had no idea that they could be digitized. And especially perhaps as a zine maker, thinking about that from, you know, having made zines in the 1990s before I was even conscious of a thing called the internet, that there'd be a possibility later of having my zines completely scanned and available in a collection. And on one hand, it seems great. And then on the other hand, it's like, but I'm also grateful that I wasn't a teenager at the time of social media and that I didn't share all this content that way and that it isn't permanently out there. You know, that somebody has to dig pretty hard to find it. And if they do, like, wonderful, I'm happy that they found it. But I don't know if I just want it out there. You know, it's like a conflicted feeling. Yet at the same time, it also seems like that's more of an ego-based response of just being embarrassed about it or wanting my privacy, as opposed to thinking about a collective prerogative for information being accessible, you know, in terms of thinking about the most broadest sense of history and being inclusive of, you know, teenage girls in the 1990s, like having their voices be available. Like, that's pretty powerful also, you know? So, yeah, it's complicated.
And there's a certain compulsion, I feel like, now where you, given the choice, you know, if you're not digitizing it then or creating it electronically, then how are you even going to circulate this thing, right? Like, here's the pre-analog life that we've lived coming into not confrontation, but just like a different half of your brain with the students that we deal with today who are, they're born in the sort of electronic landscape, thinking about sharing on social media, but also, yes, you having the experience of being a zinester in a period in which you are able to editorialize your life. But, you know, is it necessarily a journal? Like the zine itself?
Kind of. Right. Sometimes.
Which is great. But you were making it to share, right?
That's right. But it never occurred to me that anybody would be looking at it 30 years later. You know, that I really just thought it was something I was making for this particular community that I was a part of at that period of time.
And, you know, zines, of course, as you know, that like this is many communities struggle with this idea, like whose voices are in the archives and who consented at what point to that process of being archived, who's being described in certain ways. You know, this is a big part of the field now, is kind of like thinking through harmful language that archivists have employed to tell people about the things that they have and needing to kind of go back to the archivist's work and rewrite it, or at least
that's fascinating,
re-describe the way that, you know, the aggregator is drawing you to something that isn't even the content. It's the way that it has been sort of bucketed, or Library of Congress subject headings is a perfect example of this, where It's just it is uniform because data needs to be uniform versus like what is the community's need for a word to describe themselves.
Yeah, or like the nightmare that is the Dewey Decimal System. Like
right.
Unbelievable, those classifications. Oh my goodness.
Just needing to like impose a structure, right?
Right. Here's
the information authority telling you what's what. So that also leads into my other sort of next topic of conversation that I wanted to have with you. You know, mentioning zines, we have some of your zines in the collection.
Yes.
You know, whether
yes.
you consented to them.
I think it's great that they're in the collection.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because we do use them in your classes.
Yeah.
So hopefully it's not too embarrassing.
No, not at all. It's always funny. But yeah, I like to show early work to students anyway, because I just think it helps them understand this idea of like a lifelong practice, you know, and like what that can look like and how it can take different shapes and forms, and how once I was even younger than they are now, you know, like that's always an interesting thought experiment for them.
Do you want to share with our listeners your zine name of that period?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So it was Muffin Bones in the 1990s. So that was from like 93 to 98. And then I published a zine called Memory Town USA, which is from like 98 to 2001. And then I made a zine called Parfait for about like 2003 to. So the problem with the dates with all these titles is I'll bring them back for like one issue. So like there was like a Muffin Bones number 20 or something in 2011. So occasionally the titles recirculate later. But yeah, those are the Muffin Bones and Memory Town were really personal zines. Like it was very much about personal life. And then Parfait is like a little bit more experimental in terms of there's some short fiction and kind of like weird little artist projects. I guess there was always short fiction in Muffin Bones too. So I guess they've always been kind of like an artist workbook sort of thing of just like anything I was interested in at the time, I would just kind of dump it in, you know, but on a publishing schedule. So Muffin Bones, I made 4 times a year. And so it was kind of like, I just, anything I was interested in for 3 months, I would just kind of then funnel into the scene, and then I'd publish it, and then I'd move on to the next issue, which was really fun. Like, I missed that way of working, honestly. But it seems difficult now to find time to publish the process materials in a way, which is in a way what the zine is, in addition to the longer term, bigger project work that I'm trying to do. But yeah, I love zines so much, and they were just so formative for me that I could talk about them for forever.
And the self-publication aspect of it allows you to put out number 20 like 15 years
That's right.
after
yeah.
and like be your own editor and be your own sort of like timetable keeper.
Sometimes quite to my own detriment. But yeah, nonetheless, that's right. Nobody's to tell you that you can't do it. Like, that's the best thing about self-publishing. No gatekeepers.
And you're still making zines or reprinting or adding to previous runs?
Yeah. So that was, I had never done that before. But last fall in November, so Printed Matter organized an event called the Sunday Zine Fair at the Brooklyn Museum in conjunction with an exhibition at the Brooklyn Museum called Copy Machine Manifestos, Artists Who Make Zines. And I was not in that exhibition, although I had some friends who were in the exhibition, which was exciting. But in conjunction with the exhibition, they organized the zine fair that was one day only. And they asked us to bring old work from the, like, in my case, it would be from the 90s, but, you know, just... other people obviously have been publishing for longer or more recently, but just this idea of showing like a broader spectrum of zines. And so it just kind of gave me the idea to reprint just 2 old issues. So like Muffin Bones number 18 and Memory Town USA number 2. So this is, we're talking 1997 and 1998. And so it's interesting having those back in the world at this moment in time.
Yeah, I mean, that period I can remember somewhat vividly, and just even thinking about who it is that was making zines at that time versus who was making zines like 10 years before that, mm-hmm. you know, just even charting that path of like zine making across the decades, because we can describe it as that. This is a pretty old medium now. We're coming up on like 100 years.
100 years, yeah.
So it's fascinating to see what the uptake is today. And I'm excited that you are bringing your students to see zines, you know, probably showing your own work in zines, in studio. And of course, that's something the library is very interested in as well. But in terms of the historical object, you know, of course, we've kind of gone over some of those abilities to be editorializing, to be self-published. But getting back to that idea of, you know, this is a process document, how do you feel like that as an artist was somewhat of a new way of doing creative writing or creative design? Was the zine something that maybe you couldn't find any other place in terms of a medium to work in?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, calling it a process document is, I guess, how I think of it now, but I don't, and it was definitely very much like one of the biggest gifts of making personal zines in the 90s, although probably at any time, was realizing how much more observant it made me. Like, I felt like I had a constant state of attention because I was interested in everything that was happening because it could potentially be used in my zine. And I don't think I would have used the language of it being a process document back then to describe that. But in a way, that's what it is. And again, I'm also not sure I was conscious of zines really being an art form exactly. Like, maybe I felt like they were, but because they weren't seen that way, nobody had ever used that language to describe them, besides maybe us zine makers. Like, we're like, it was confusing in that sense, I guess, of whether or not this was a legitimate art making practice or this was just something we were doing, or were we doing it for reasons that weren't art, which is actually the most powerful way of making art, is making art that's not art, but it's just that you're making it because you're living your life and this is what you want to make, and then that's your art, right? But I think as a teenager, I didn't have like a framework really for thinking about that. I think, you know, around the same time, shortly after, like in college, I started making artist books, like letterpress printed and with these like fancy bindings, and they'd be sold to special collections for large sums of money. And my own friends who used to trade zines with me couldn't afford them. I think there was like a period of time there where I thought maybe the artist books were my real work and like the zines were something else. But over time, I began to realize that the zines were the real thing. And I mean, and so were the artist books were also real, but the zines were no less real, right? The zines were no less real. And I think what happened over time for me is I realized I was just much more interested in making work for a peer group than making work specifically that could only end up in special collections because other people couldn't afford it. Now, that doesn't mean I'm against special collections buying my affordable work. Like, I am happy for it to end up at special collections. I think that's wonderful. Like, I want future researchers and I want students to be able to access the work in this way and like put it in a much larger context. That is such a privilege. But in terms of the motivation for making the work or like thinking about who the audience for the work is, it's very important to me that it lives first in the world, that it's very accessible, that it's being, you know, just like zines, like out of a print run of maybe 300, you know, probably at least 150 of those I would trade for other zines, you know, and then like maybe 100 of them I would sell. Like, somebody would send me $1 and 2 stamps through the mail. But like most of them were trades with other zine makers. And that to me is like really what made zine making so special, or makes zine making so special. It's really about a peer exchange and a community that comes out of that peer exchange, as opposed to making an object that is sold.
It's fascinating because I feel like I want to talk about Marxism with you now. About labor theory of value and, you know, what is a commodity?
Yes.
When do things become not as personal anymore because you've had to do it for work?
That's right. Yeah.
And I'm wondering if maybe you could explain a little bit, and maybe I'm jumping the gun here, if you could talk a little bit about being the co-founder of the Impractical Labor in Service of the Speculative Arts. Is there any of that kind of philosophy that you are imbuing in that kind of a title and organization?
Graham, yes, 200,000%.
Like,
so,
I had a feeling.
Yes, yes. So Impractical Labor, which we also call ILSA for short, that was co-founded with my friend Bridget Elmer. And we actually met in New York over 20 years ago when we were both working for Brooklyn Artists Alliance. And we were both, you know, I was coming from making zines and was making artist books and was involved, becoming involved with this Artist Alliance. She had just moved to New York and was coming from a background in social justice and anthropology and was interested in making and using zines. And we met and became like super fast friends. We ended up both going to grad school. I went to school for graphic design and she went to school for book arts. And we both felt kind of frustrated by the parameters of our programs. And we're thinking back to like why we were making books in the first place. And especially as letterpress printers, if we were interested in making work that was accessible, there was no way we could be financially compensated for our labor in terms of the amount of time it would take to produce something. And so it had to be about reflecting upon what a system of value is that's not monetary. Like, what is the motivation for making things? Like, if you, obviously it's not financial compensation. People need financial compensation to live, right? But that's not the reason why they make things. They make things out of this, right? This sense of urgency or curiosity or acute attention or care. Like it comes from other places. And so ILSA became a way for us to explore these ideas. And so the way that it worked is we opened it up as a membership organization. And so people would join for what was initially $12 a year. And then later we raised it to $20 a year. But we also always had a caveat that like if you couldn't afford dues, like that we would trade or, you know, some other way of making membership accessible. And we would send out call and response publications through the mail asking people to reflect upon their practice as impractical laborers. So, for example, one project was a survey asking people to reflect upon their working conditions as artists, even though they themselves, of course, were their bosses, right? So they're the ones creating the unsatisfactory working conditions for themselves. But we gave people a rubric from sociology in terms of what makes for satisfied workers and like ask them to consider that. And of course, everyone is like, wow, I am a terrible boss, you know? So there's like a lot of obviously also internalization of not feeling worthy as an artist, of course, if you're not earning money from your work, that really is like there's so much absorption of that larger cultural value. Mm. And so much of ILSA was about creating space to really reflect upon why you do what you do and like how that's valuable. Mm-hmm. And like what value is. So we started that in 2008 and only recently has the membership organization part kind of fizzled out a bit in terms of like it's no longer feeling sustainable in terms of the amount of work that it is. But we're considering now just moving forward to like a project-based model that whenever we have, say, like a project we want to explore, we'll then email the listserv. So again, joining ILSA now as a member is free. Like it's just you just join the listserv and then you'll hear from us that way. So can I say a call to action on the radio? Is that
sure? Let's take it. Yeah.
So it is impractical-labor.org, and you can read more about our activities there. And if you're interested, you just sign up for the free listserv. And we email very infrequently, so don't worry, we're not going to spam you. It's really the heart of the organization is coming from people who use obsolete technology, so we're not always on our screens.
Well, we'll put a link to that in the show notes, as usual. So would you say that this collective organizational process kind of came as a reaction to maybe some of the draconian studio art making that happens on kind of a commercial scale? Mm. I just think of some scenarios in which I have friends, artists who, you know, by dint of putting their hours in, working in someone else's studio on painting in certain parts of a painting for them, and having an unsatisfactory experience doing so. Is this kind of part of a response to what the life of a working artist is like?
I think there's definitely no one particular type of member we have. Like the range of people who come to us, I'd say, is really, really broad. I think for Bridget and myself, Ilse was a way of both maintaining our friendship, because like we've always, Ilse has always been long distance. We met in New York in the early 2000s, but you know, she moved to Alabama. I'm a Connecticut lifer pretty much. So I was back in Connecticut. And so it was, collaborating together was a way of maintaining our friendship, but it's also really just about exploring these ideas for ourselves, like just trying to figure out why we do what we do, what makes things feel worthwhile, how can we create a community out of, for like-minded individuals who are also interested in exploring these topics, how can we learn about what other people are doing who share our values, but otherwise we might not meet. So I'd say we probably have some members who work in that sort of environment where they might have an art job, right? Like an art world job, but it's extremely alienating in terms of they don't have any autonomy or recognition for their work. But then I'd say we also probably have a lot of, you know, we have some people who definitely earn a living from making their work. So like, for example, like calligraphers, right? Or letterpress printers who focus on weddings. Like, those people often make a good living from their work, but then they might feel there's that divide of like, when is your work not your work, right? Like, when is work for a commercial sphere different from the work that you would make for yourself? So just because you're practicing your skills, right, or that you're engaged in the processes you love to be doing, it's not necessarily fulfilling, right? Mm-hmm. But then you feel like you can't complain because it's also pretty amazing to be able to make a living doing what you love doing, right? So it's kind of like navigating that space.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Even thinking about what is the role of a union within an artist's shop and where does that exist?
Yes, yeah. So the way we describe Ilse is that we're a union for immaterial working conditions. So we can't help you with vacation time or better compensation, but we're here to help improve how you think about what you do, right? That it's about, so much of it is like a perspective or a mindset of valuing impractical labor.
That's amazing. I mean, even trying to take the time to step back for the sort of broader view, because of course, as you mentioned, you know, like you're driven by creative need, you're driven
right.
by like urgency to produce. And then also the market is the other thing trying to keep you housed and like fed and all of these other pressures that a society that maybe doesn't favor a particular kind of art versus like, oh, like if you want to do design for a Marvel movie, you know, you might be employed under also maybe difficult. I don't know how they're employed and what the working conditions are.
Caveat.
But
don't come after us for that statement.
Just generalizing that I can see the need and I'm inspired by that. So thanks for sharing about that.
Yeah.
Maybe to pivot to another project that you're involved in that has a pretty significant archival overlap is Alder and Frankia. And I'm hoping you can kind of talk about the origins of that and maybe some of the processes of you going into archives and producing something. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that something.
Yeah. Yeah. So Alder and Frankia, I started in 2016. And the name comes from, so the alder is a birch tree that lives in really adverse conditions, thanks to Frankia, which lives in its roots, which is a microorganism. And so the idea is that it's a symbiotic relationship where the alder feeds the Frankia, basically like some type of carbon dioxide that the Frankia converts to sugar that then allows the alder, that is basically like plant food for the alder. And so, you know, that they both live together in these inhospitable environments. And so I just really love that metaphor for this idea of collaboration, you know. So it first started to make some more book length work that felt outside the scope of Ilse, because with Ilse, we send, you know, at least one mailing to our members per year. And, you know, it's a participatory project, but I became interested in working with other artists. And then I was interested in making a book with Bloodroot. So Bloodroot is a feminist restaurant, bookstore, and work collective, which has been in Bridgeport, Connecticut since 1977. And Bridgeport is where my studio is. And I've been in that area since 2005. So I also had, you know, deep roots in that area. And I had first come to Bloodroot when I was a teenager in the 1990s. So it was also just like a formative place for me. So making that book, I spent a lot of time in Bloodroot's archive at Yale, the manuscripts and archives collection there. And then also what didn't make it into that collection, which was in the back storage room of the restaurant. And so I spent some time in the back storage room in the restaurant, but many hours at Yale just going through the archives, like collecting basically essays, photographs, most of those by Noel Feary, and then essays often by Selma Miriam. Both of those two women were two of the main founders of Bloodroot. So the first obvious thing that came out of that project was, of course, the book, right? So it's called Our Daily Lives Have to Be a Satisfaction in Themselves, 40 Years of Bloodroot. The initial print runs, I edited it, designed it, printed it, risograph, hand-bound, an edition of 200 copies. Bloodroot sold it at their restaurant, and I sold it online and at art book fairs, and it sold out super fast, like in 6 months, which I was not anticipating. And so I did it again, Graham, which is insane to me. Another 200 copies, risograph printed, hand-bound, and then that sold out. And so then I was like, okay, I could spend the rest of my life just remaking this book, but like, I don't think I want to do that. So then I got like an offset printed edition, actually using my startup funds from the University of Connecticut.
Nice.
Thank you, University of Connecticut. And have kept that book in print. So the book is made from the archives, right? That was kind of like the first book I had made from the archives. But by spending time in their archives, I started discovering all this historic ephemera that really spoke to the current moment. So there was an essay by Dr. Dorothy Tenov, who was the first women's studies professor at the University of Bridgeport, which is where I used to teach myself. And so there was like this personal connection there. And it was just an essay that, you know, was sold as a mimeograph sheet at Bloodroot for 25 cents. And it just felt really, really pertinent. And so I knew I wanted to republish that. And then I found this amazing issue of a magazine called Maze. And it was a special issue, Saving Seeds, Metaphors for Lesbian Growth. And it was edited by Jenna Weston, who's an artist who's lives in Florida now, on a lesbian land that she created. And the magazine is all contributions from women around the world of their female-centered gardens. And so it's all these diagrams and drawings and then photographs. And then Jenna's writing and artwork. And it's just this extremely beautiful issue. And so it was in Bloodroot's archive because they had a contribution in it about their garden. But like there was just so much in there that I knew people would want to see. And so that then sent me, I became curious about like, oh, well, I should probably check out some other archives. So I went to the Barnard Center for Research on Women and found this amazing pamphlet about the New York Black Women's Health Project from the 1990s that felt like it was discussing the exact same issues that Black women are fighting for today in terms of healthcare. And back at the Dodd, I learned about the work of Peggy Chin. So Peggy Chin is a retired UConn professor. She lives in Oakland, California. She was a professor of nursing here at UConn, and she was a co-founder of Cassandra, the Radical Feminist Nurses Network, in the 1980s, and then also wrote a number of books, often co-authored, again, often with collaborators that also were involved in forming Cassandra, but about feminist process, like how to collaborate together, and then also another book on aesthetics and nursing. Just so many really interesting ideas. She's such a prolific and just like engaging and just really generous person. So basically through this project, whenever people were still alive, I would contact them. And if they weren't alive, I didn't contact the descendants. No, I'm just saying this on the radio. And again, I think this gets back to this issue of who does this work belong to, which is the same question really about the zines I made in the 1990s. Are they actually mine or do they belong to like a greater collective? And I think that's especially true when we think about political work that, you know, when the New York Black Women's Health Project was publishing this leaflet and when Dr. Dorothy Tenoff was writing about female psychology, they wanted this work to reach the broadest audience possible. You know, they weren't, I'm sure they also wanted credit for their work, you know, absolutely. But, you know, they're interested in audience and reach. And the idea that that a child could possibly not give permission for something to be reprinted when they didn't make it, it just seemed to me like I wasn't sure I wanted to give somebody that power. Mm-hmm. But it's obviously a sensitive topic, for sure.
And the role of the archives, you know, just in terms of how we think about that process, yeah, is that we provide preservation. Like, if you are trying to reach your here and now community, that's the work of the active record. It's out there doing its job, reaching the communities it needs. And then it's sort of archival life is kind of after the fact. Mm. And then hopefully the rest of human time can come back and re-engage with that. And it sounds like that's exactly what you're doing. Not that the issues, as you found, for the Black Women's Health Collective are not the exact same issues today, but you almost like resuscitating that work demonstrates the role of the archival record to bring it back to the fore. If that community, yeah, is based on the life and energy of one woman, then let's have another woman pick it back up and bring it back out. And
so much of it is about recirculation, absolutely, just like getting it back out there. I think I'm very, you know, I'm sensitive, especially the New York Black Women's Health Project. That organization doesn't exist anymore, but there's a parent organization, the Black Women's Health Imperative, that does. And so since I do sell that, I donate to the Black Women's Health Imperative. Like, that's very important to me, to see the republication of it as continuing their work, right? But in some cases, there isn't an exact, right, like, source of like, where would Dr. Dorothy Tenoff want her work to go? Like, I know she was involved with NOW back in the day, but that's a different perhaps today she would choose a different organization, right? There are fewer choices back then of who's doing this sort of work. So yeah, I guess I just see it all as part of feminist practice of just, but it's really also just about honoring these people's work, right? Like, that they did this, they made these significant contributions that often you can see a ripple effect decades later, but you're unfamiliar with the source of maybe where this idea came from. Or maybe there's like a tactic or a tech or an idea for a conference or like some type of strategy of organizing that wouldn't occur to you now. But then when you encounter it, you're like, ah, this is perfect. Like, I could try this. And so what I love about book fairs and sharing this work at book fairs is that there are people who come and encounter the ephemera and are like, I had no idea there was this Radical Feminist Nurses Network. I'm a nurse. Does this still exist? Like, it needs to exist. And so it becomes like a catalyst, I think, for people in their own activism to be able to have this encounter from the past kind of unexpectedly, you know, as opposed to having to go to the archives themselves and dig through archaic subject file folder headings.
But if you want to.
Yes, but you should.
We'll put a link to the collection in which Cassandra is found in the show notes. So just in case we can resuscitate also other new engagement with it. I mean, what you're describing is so inspiring just in terms of like how the full circle can kind of become a perpetual promotion of, you know, the legacies of radical women's movements.
Yes.
And something that has historically sort of been kept to the margins and trying to like bring it from the historical past into a place that might be far more accessible and disseminated. And I know we're running close to time, but are there any projects or work currently that you want to share about?
Oh, sure. So I am currently in the midst of a big archival project that is a book with an extraordinary woman, Kay Kodesh, who is a Connecticut resident. She is a lifelong activist, advocate. She was the first director for the Women's Center, Office of Women in Medicine at Yale. It's a lot of prepositions in there. She left that to be an AIDS advocate in New Haven. And then she became, to everyone's surprise, the first civilian and first woman director of the New Haven Police Academy in 1992. And so this was when New Haven was starting community policing under Nick Pastor. So this was a time when they were, you know, New Haven had just elected its first Black mayor, John C. Daniels. He had gone to high school with Nick Pastor. And so they had this long history together. And it was clear to everyone in New Haven that policing had to be done differently. And so it was a way of really reimagining policing as a collaboration between people in the community and then the police. And so obviously to do that type of work, it's like a redefinition of the way policing was done in this country. And so it required a totally different education. And so they brought in a feminist activist who had gone to the police chief to complain about how police officers were harassing gay men. That's how they first met. She is the one who got the job as director of the academy. And so she was there until 2008, when basically she got pushed out. But that's still a long time to be doing that type of work. And so a lot of the book is from her personal collection, so like her unprocessed archive in the file room at her house. There's also a lot of work, a lot of research records from Professor Susan Sturm, who's now a law professor at Columbia University and the director for the Center for Institutional Change. But back in the 90s, she was a law professor at UPenn and was doing this research project about can diversifying institutions actually significantly change them, and can combat racism by diversification? Is it possible? Is it going to work? And so she came and studied the academy for that reason, and then a variety of other reasons in terms of this idea of the impact of what they were doing. So it's been a massive project. I've been working on it since 2020, and it started out of an exhibition at ArtSpace New Haven and a grant that they gave. So I'm really grateful for that. And Frank Mitchell, who curated that show. And I have a sabbatical, hopefully, knock on for Micah, coming up next year to hopefully finish that book. But yeah, that's what I'm deep in right now.
Wow, you're not busy at all. This is no sweat for a summer project. Even just thinking about like the trust building to see those papers in someone's personal possession and it is their legacy.
Yes.
That must have been an interesting navigating.
It's a constant negotiation. I think, you know, Kay is understandably very protective and very private. And so when I first contacted her, she first sent me this giant envelope that was like enormously generous and just like all this material. But when I kept on asking, could I see this? They were kind of doled out one at a time. And now 4 years later, I'm like in the file room with her, just yes, like going through the folders. So yeah, it's definitely been all about trust. But Susan Sturm, you know, amazingly FedExed to my house her boxes, her original boxes of research, which for an academic is kind of unheard of. I mean, for feminist academics, it makes more sense, right? Like they're into power sharing, right? But in general, like academics don't have a reputation for being generous with their research, right? And these are her original boxes, not copies.
Wow.
So yeah, I'm enormously grateful. I wouldn't be able to make a book without Kay and without Susan. I mean, clearly without Kay, because like we need the work that she did. Right. But without Susan's research, it would be a much diminished book.
That's really impressive, Emily. Just even, yeah, like knowing the work that goes into building those relationships, which typically take like many, many years. I'm sure you're on that same path, and it clearly shows that they see you as a steward, which is really awesome.
Thank you.
It's inspiring. So I have one last question, and I did some reading because I wanted to prepare. I know we're in our like closing few minutes here, but why Risograph, Emily Larned?
Oh, gosh, why? So to me, I guess I had always wanted a photocopier, but I never had one. And so when I became aware of Rizzo in maybe around like 20, the first artist publications I saw were maybe like 2012 or so, maybe 2010. I was just really intrigued. I'm like, so here's a machine that's as simple to operate as a photocopier, but yet you can put in all these different color drums and then, you know, print in one color at a time. And as an undergraduate student, I was a printmaking concentration. I was an art major, printmaking concentration. And so this idea of this sort of half photocopier, half printmaking process is just enormously appealing. other Rizzo features are that the masters are made out of banana skin, which the master is like a stencil. Like you imagine screen printing with a stencil. So masters are made out of banana skin, and the inks are soy based, and it's a very low energy machine. So unlike a photocopier, which gets hot to like seal the toner against the paper, the Rizzo doesn't get hot. It maintains a low temperature, so it doesn't use a lot of power. Have you seen it, Graham? It's so cool. So like that's
yes. Like
so that's why.
I mean, like the office innovation world, you know, like yes. That stuff is also just totally fascinating. Like learning about the history of just mimeograph and duplicators to get to then the place where we can think about risograph as like a more soft footprint for the art printing and just publication printing in general. And it comes out of office supply world.
Totally. And so many colors, such an interesting process. I love that you can just, again, it doesn't take any skill or you know, you can learn how to use it in just a few minutes. So it's great showing it to students too, because there's just so much potential. You know, like a lot of illustrators use it in really beautiful ways where they layer a lot of colors. I'm more interested in it, I guess, as a more like immediate kind of like down and dirty printing process where you can just make something multicolor or even just one color, but like a cool color, like really pretty quickly. And that's really rewarding. Like Monday, I like designed like handset type, took one proof of it on letterpress, digitally redesigned it into a poster, and then printed it on the Rizzo in like edition of 75 copies in 5 hours. And like that's just exciting, right? Like if it was all letterpress, it would have taken way longer. If it was all digital, then I would have had to take it to a printer. But instead, I could do the whole thing in my studio in 5 hours. And that's owning the means of production.
Right. Yeah, it's a beautiful process when you can see it all the way through and in only that short period of time on your handy office supplied.
Rizzo.
It's great.
So good.
Cool. Okay, well, I'm glad I got to ask that question of you. Thanks again, Emily, for being on the program.
Thanks for having me. It was super fun.
Of course. It's been a great conversation. Again, you've been joined with myself and Emily Larned, who is an associate professor of art and graphic design here at the University of Connecticut and co-founder of Impractical Labor in Service of the Speculative Arts. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we will catch you next time.
Bye.
I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. You've been listening to another episode of Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. For more information on the Archives and Special Collections, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and the web. Our theme song is Dream in Casio Tone by Arable Lands. Graphic design by Melika Stinnett. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.